Hello and welcome to Resource Report, where we share with you important information about local nonprofits and resource organizations that support the community we share, produced by Pathways to Agency.
I am your host, Rainmaker. Today's guest is Larry Jefferson, Director of the Washington State Office of Public Defense. Here's Larry.
I am here at the State Office of Public Defense downtown in Olympia, Washington, with Larry Jefferson. And so can you please introduce what your position is and how did you come to be here?
Well, I'm the Director of Public Defense for the state of Washington. Officially, I was appointed by the Supreme Court for this position, and they took a vote. And happy to report that it was 9-0 for my appointment. We went through a process with a board. There were three candidates, and I was selected.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was very amazing. It was not something that I ever expected. One day I was working as a public defender across the water here at Thurston County Public Defense, and I got a call that there was an opening, and I was feeling pretty successful where I was, but I thought, and I went to my paralegal, and I was thinking about running for prosecutor, and they were like, Thurston County, State of Washington. Thurston County, State of Washington. And I thought to myself, if I move to the state of Washington, maybe I could do something, and that is make sure that public defenders are trained. So that was one of my main motivators for applying for this position.
Go straight to the source.
Absolutely. This organization is mainly an administrative organization, because each county is separately responsible for public defense. So there's 39 counties. So that's 39 different ways of doing public defense. And then you've got all the cities. So there are over 200 and something cities, maybe 260 cities. And so they're each separately responsible. And so we have some ways that we're administratively connected, like with finances and things of that nature. This office was created in 1996 to fill in a gap around appellate counsel. So just the funding was just completely random. There was no one who was responsible for making sure that appellate counsel received compensation or got the information they needed. And so that was one of the first missions of this office, was really to make sure that all those things were sort of standardized.
Accountability.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful. That does a decent job of explaining what the State Office of Public Defense does. Is there anything you would want to add to that?
Well, that's where we started. And so we are so much farther. So when I first got here, we had about 20 employees. As of today, we have about 80 employees, but we also contract with around 300 contractors around the state. In different things. One of our biggest programs is the Parent Representation Program, and that's where the state comes in and basically tries to remove a family member, normally a child. And so we stand in and fight for that family. And so that program started off in one county, or actually in two counties, and then grew statewide. And it took from like 2006 to 2018 to become statewide. Now it's a nationally recognized program. And so with that program, there's sort of some big things going on. One of the big things going on with that program is each contracted attorney has a caseload of, can be up to 80 cases. That's a lot of people.
That is.
We've worked with our current funding to reduce that to 65. And recently, the Supreme Court came out with an order that says in July that it should be 45 cases.
4 to 5 cases?
45.
45 cases.
45 cases, absolutely. So that's going to mean big changes for those attorneys. It's just those cases are very complicated.
Yeah.
Take a lot of time. Got to do a lot of talking. And so we're excited about those changes. So we're going to have to ask for funding for that program.
What is the difference between the state office and the county office?
Well, the main difference would be, as far as I'm concerned, is there's a portion in our statute that does not allow the attorneys here except under very limited circumstances, to practice law. So, for instance, I can't take clients.
Huh.
All right. And one of the reasons for that could be, well, then I'd have to take clients all over the state.
Right.
And so we don't have the capacity to do that. And the legislature hasn't indicated they want to fund that.
Okay.
And so the attorneys, for example, in Thurston County are the frontline public defenders. They're doing bail hearings. They're doing arraignment hearings. They're taking cases to trial. Our office, for example, with our parent representation program, we contract with attorneys to do the services.
Okay.
Right.
In the different counties.
In the different counties.
All over the counties, because you're over the states.
All over the state. We also work with the state hospitals, like Western State and Eastern State. And so it was very difficult for the county attorneys all over the state to get to those particular hospitals because they had cases sort of coming in the front door. And these are cases that were for those public defenders already completed. But for the people in the hospital, they still need to move through the different stages of the hospital, like in Eastern and West Street Hospital, you gain the ability to move around just the hospital grounds, but there's certain steps that you have to go through.
Okay.
And so now we have a group of attorneys. They know those steps, and they know how to help their clients go through the steps. And as they go through those steps, they get closer and closer to being released.
And that's the training that y'all provide to help those attorneys.
We also provide training. And so, like I mentioned before, that was one of the biggest reasons I wanted to come here.
Yeah.
Now, a couple of years before I came here, it started a small training program. And since that time, we've expanded it. So that program happens a couple of times a year for about 30 attorneys. And so we tried to focus on newer attorneys. Right, who maybe haven't done a trial before, how to do an opening, how to do a closing. And to tell you the truth, I was not trained. So when I became a public defendant, it gave me 60 cases and said, have at it. And so my overall vision and dream is that one day, when you become a public defender, you go to a training first. You learn how to listen to clients. It can be hard to listen to someone who is in trauma.
Yeah.
And sometimes that trauma comes out in ways that feels disrespectful to you as the attorney. And instead of trying to take that personally, you're trying to learn like where that comes from, how it affects different populations differently, and the things you need to do to have like cultural humility. Because what we need to be able to do is to see everyone as the unique human being that they are.
Empathize.
Right. And so we are expanding our capacity. A week ago, we did our first training for attorneys who are experienced. So sometimes you need to relearn some things.
Yeah.
Or just hear some different ideas from around the state. Like, wait, you do that over there? We could do that here. And that would improve our practice. Or just having different ways. Because attorneys do things differently. And so we want to... mainly you want our public defenders to do this thing called object. The government has gotten involved in someone's life and that person generally doesn't like that. And so we've got to be the advocates and we can't expect the judge to like us. We cannot expect the prosecutor to like us or the witnesses. So it's not about being liked and that could be very hard, especially when maybe you're in a rural community and there's a limited amount of folks. And so you might see your judge at the grocery store or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's hard to be like, no, I'm going to object. But we want to teach people to do that and to really advocate for their client and get the training they need in order to execute.
It can be really hard to go against the grain, and that's really powerful.
Yes. And one of the components of that is that we're committed to racial justice here. And there's some things that have happened. The land that we're on was stolen from the people who lived here. I'm African American, and my people were enslaved. And then there are people who have done work and have never been compensated for that work. For instance, Chinese exclusion.
Like, yep.
There was a vibrant community here in Olympia that dissolved in the 1880s. And so there's never been any recognition for those things at a systematic level. And so those things are really affecting us in our court today about who's got opportunities, who doesn't, redlining, voting rights, all of these things, housing, education, all those things show up in our clients. And so folks that are having dysfunction, we tend to blame an individual for systemic problems. And so we really want to be there for that individual. We want to be there so that we can tell their story. Because if their story can be told, you can understand why they did something. So some of the, and so one of the things I really didn't realize that I learned from our parent representation program is that mass incarceration starts at birth. It's also a denial of Indigenous people's rights.
That's fact.
And so we want to make sure that our agency knows about those things so that when those facts come up in a case, we can make sure that we are not causing more harm.
Right.
That we are taking the right steps. Mm-hmm. And at least that if we have that knowledge and we share that with our client, it doesn't mean that we can prevent the injustice all the time, but it does mean it just makes a big difference when everyone is aware about what's happening. And then we can take steps. One of my favorite programs in parent representation is working with women who are suffering and families who are suffering with substance abuse. I think they should be able to make a phone call without getting in trouble about that. And so we connected with, in six counties, we've connected with different clinics and hospitals where they can call us. We can come in immediately before a case is filed and help to resolve the situation. And that agency can still call CPS or the authorities. And so what we found is we've been able to reduce cases for people going into foster care in those particular counties around 70 to 75% of the time. So those children are never separated from their mothers and their mothers get access to treatment. So one day I hope to expand that throughout the whole state. And I think it's something the whole country should do, because why should we have to wait until a family member has been taken in order to provide a legal service?
An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Right. And so that's one of the things that I think people have a misconception with about public defense.
Okay.
We're the one entity that gets to talk to everyone. So a person has the right to remain silent, but we get the opportunity to talk to them. If we're trauma-informed about how we talk to the individual, we can know whether they're amenable to different programs and things of that nature. One of my hopes is that we're going to change how we do domestic violence here in the state of Washington.
Oh, good.
And we're holding a restorative justice conference in April, because there are some times when people who have been harmed don't want to prosecute in a traditional way. And so we need to have other ways that are victim-centered so that they can get the healing they need. So why can't we work with our dispute resolution centers, our different YWCAs, and make sure that folks that have been harmed get the information they need so they don't get harmed again. But also then once you've checked with that, you can check with the person that caused harm to see if they are safe in order to get the information they need so that this doesn't have to happen all the time.
Let's go over those programs that y'all have now, actually. The Appellate program. Can you explain clearly what that is for people who may not know?
That's our appellate program. And so when you take your case to trial and you lose, in the state of Washington, you have the constitutional right to appeal that case. And so we have a number of contractors that provide that service. And so that's where we have like our Court of Appeals and then our Supreme Court. And so what we want to ensure is that everything that happened in their trial is reflected in the record. We get those records. The attorney looks over those records and then spots issues to appeal.
Okay.
And so that is the primary purpose of that program. In that program, there's issues with caseloads. And so there's currently a study out. And so those caseloads may be getting reduced, or we may be asking for funding to reduce those caseloads for that particular program.
You said study out. What's that mean?
So there is a study to see how much time does it take for the attorneys to do certain types of appeals.
Okay.
And so usually one of the biggest factors is the transcript length. So if the transcript is like 2,000 pages or something of that nature, that might reflect that the trial took 2 weeks. It's going to take longer for the appellate attorney to read all that information. Okay. There's going to be more issues.
That'll be more time-consuming.
Time-consuming.
Okay.
We're trying to make some changes.
Okay.
Because for years, our caseload level was at 36, which is about 3 a month, which is unsustainable. In other states, it's completely different. And so I'm looking forward to making changes in that program. One of the difficult parts of the office is getting a phone call where you have to tell someone that you can't help.
That's hard.
And so that is particularly difficult.
Yeah.
When I first got here, we did not have a receptionist.
Oh, my goodness.
So that kind of told me that we didn't want you to call us because we don't have a receptionist to answer the phone. And so I really had to work to change that so that we had a receptionist, because we want folks to call and we want to get these challenging questions.
Yeah.
Because sometimes that's how we move forward. That's how I learn.
Yeah.
It's by getting an issue and going, we don't have this resource. And then and then turning that into a program. One of the areas we've been able to do this is in our 5046 program. So after an appeal, you have the right to petition the court with something called a personal restraint petition. Well, in the state of Washington, you're not entitled to counsel for that petition. So if you have money, you could do that. There's a lot of people that do them themselves, but they don't know how to do it right. And you can only do it once. And once you do it once and you do it wrong, you're not allowed to do it again. And then the folks that are really challenged to do this after you've been found guilty, either by plea or jury, and after your sentencing, you have 1 year to file this paperwork. So when you do it yourself, you have to learn everything a lawyer knows, which is, I don't know, 7 years of schooling, right? 4 years of college, 3 years of law school, plus knowing about PRP. So maybe about 10 years of experience. You got to learn all that in 1 year, plus get all of the facts from your case. The facts can't be the same. They can't deal with the same issues that were in your appeal. So there are issues that are outside of your appeal that aren't on the record. So that means maybe your attorney didn't bring a witness, or that the judge committed misconduct, or the prosecutor committed misconduct that is in the record.
It almost feels like they did that intentionally to make it hard for people.
You know, I'm not going to comment on that. But what I will say is what we did is say, we need to be able to take action here, especially what if you cannot, what if you're juvenile? What if you can't read or write in English? What if you have mental health issues? And so we have started a limited program where we look at those factors and then we assign attorneys to help. And so...
I bet that's made a huge difference.
Well, it means that we're able to review things. And so we do have some issues with, I really want to do this work over here, but how do we keep to our statute? So that's something that we're still struggling with. But it was an issue that came about because people called. And I just couldn't say no. And so we worked with the legislature. And it's a bipartisan because people believe in the rule of law. That's what I find to be, you know, really important.
And then explain the Blake program, what that is about.
Well, in April of 2021, the Supreme Court in State versus Blake overturned all of the possession convictions in the state of Washington that had been occurring since 1971. The reason that it was overturned was that it was a per se offense. So if you had the drugs on you, you were guilty, meaning it didn't matter what your intent was. Right. So
somebody could have planted it on you.
Either someone could have planted it on you, or you could be grandma, pick up drugs to put it in the garbage. But because you were holding the drugs, you were presumptively guilty.
Wow.
Unless you could prove to the jury, hey, I didn't know what it was. And then the jury would decide whether they believed it or not.
Guilty till proven innocent.
Yes. So the Supreme Court said no. And so this was one of the biggest staves in my legal career, because we had all these people charged with felon possession of narcotics. They were in prison, all over the place. There's like 300 to 250,000 records of convictions that need to be undone. And so it's just a massive overtaking. So first we had to make sure we got people like out of jail immediately. Second, we had to figure out who was in jail, and nobody knew. So,
wow.
This office was instrumental in creating that list so they could get out. So there was a person here in this office, Nicole Dodge. We figured that out. And without Nicole in Thurston County, for instance, we wouldn't have known who our clients were that were in prison, because that information.
That's huge.
It was huge.
Yeah.
And so. We received funding to help people get resentenced, and they needed to. We got money to do outreach to communities, and we're still working to vacate these convictions off of folks' records. We're working with the Office of Administrative of the Courts, and they've got an administrative unit that can be invited to any community. And so if that community invites them in, they'll organize a vacate day. And so I think in Grays Harbor, I think they went to Grays Harbor County, if I got it right. It did like 1,200 to 1,800 in one day. And that's amazing. We have a new program in regards to, we call it the Simple Possession Advocacy and Representation Program. And it provides funding for all the gross misdemeanor drug offenses around the state of Washington. And one of the things that some county public defenders don't have are social workers. So these social workers get involved in these cases, and they're able to deal with the true issues that are going on. Because to me, all crime is trauma. Find out what the trauma is. Sometimes it's substance abuse. Sometimes it's a different thing. But we get to ask all those questions. So that's been a really important resource that I'd like to increase. I think that if a person is showing issues, we should get him a social worker.
Absolutely.
And that social worker should work with him. So what I'm trying to do is increase our capacity in different programs where we have social workers, so that we build up this network. So those are some of the things that I'm kind of looking for and excited about.
That's wonderful. Wonderful. And then the disproportionality advocacy. What is that about?
Well, racism is alive and well in our society. Systematic racism is alive and well. If you just look at sentencing, or if you look at any part of the justice system, the darker your skin color, the worse the results are for you, and the more convictions and the longer sentences that people have.
Yeah.
And so what that program is to help, how can we combat this? How can we come up with different strategies? I don't know if you ever called anyone a racist before, but that's difficult to do, especially if you have to see them the next day and they're your judge, they're the prosecutor, and those things. And so it's trying to, in my opinion, how much data can we get? For instance, with juries.
Yeah.
We know that with juries, the more multicultural and diverse your jury is, the longer they tend to think about things.
Definitely.
Right? And so, to me, everybody, including white people, need diverse juries.
Absolutely.
So we need to have juries that have everybody on it.
Yeah.
And so we need to remove the legacies. We need to come up with ways that if there are people of color in the jury, giving the attorney the ability to go, we don't want this jury, and having that be okay, so that we then get a jury that reflects the demographics of the location, right? And also within that process, you've got some judges that won't let you ask the race of the person who's on the jury. But that's information we need to know in case they get excluded, because historically, folks, people of color, or just when I started, the prosecutors would make sure that all the black people were off the jury, because they knew that if there are black people on the jury, I might be able to talk to them, or they would take more time to listen to my story.
There's an assumption of, you know, people will think racist thoughts, and that really is not always the case, and you just never know who you're dealing with, and that makes things difficult, to be fair.
I think that it really does. And I think that, you know, women make assumptions.
Right.
And there's the old adage. And so what we need to do, especially in the law, is to ask questions.
Yeah.
Instead of making assumptions, do things like jury questionnaires so that we can ask those questions in, you know, in a way that people can answer them truthfully, without, you know, putting it on the spot as much as possible. And then sometimes, because it's court, some people need to be put on the spot.
Right.
It's court. It's adversarial. And we know that going in. So I'm really proud of that program. They're doing trainings not only in the state, but around the country. There's a rule called GR37 in regards to jury trials and how jurors are selected. But basically allows a judicial officer to take into consideration sort of the history. And so if the exclusion could be looked at in a historical way, meaning that a person knows the history of racism, and that's how the exclusion could be looked at in the state of Washington, they can go, no, we're not going to exclude that person because there's been a legacy in history of racism.
Yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
That's a way that we want to teach attorneys. That's a way you can fight it, where you don't have to call your opponent a racist. And we can take that off the table because that's not what it's about. So I'm really proud of that program.
That is really wonderful. That really is good. It just makes me feel so good to see that work being done. Thank you. Let's see, Extraordinary Criminal Justice Costs Act.
Those are costs in regards to like aggravated murders. And so this is just my opinion, and I'm not trying to make a statement here.
Yeah.
But I don't believe the counties receive sufficient funding or have sufficient funding. And so this is a way that when they have an aggravated murder, and those cases could take 6 weeks, 8 weeks, it could take years to prepare for them. This allows them to ask for money and compensation if it exceeds certain level of their budget.
So and so that helps request reimbursement for those cases.
Yes.
So that would be the court fees are reimbursed.
The attorney time, the expert time,
okay.
Witness travel fees, all those things.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. That helps clarify that. Forensic Civil Commitment Program.
That is the program involving McNeil Island, right? All the folks there that they're called sexually violent predator cases. I don't like that name. I believe they're human beings. And so we contract with different attorneys to provide services for that program.
Mm-hmm. Pay.
Hey, that's also the program involving Western State Hospital and Eastern State Hospital. We call that not guilty by reason of insanity. And so you get that finding, have to go to the hospital, and then we represent those individuals to help get them out of the hospital.
Okay.
And so in the state of Washington, if that finding is made, then you're going to stay at the hospital. If it's a Class C felony, you could stay up to 5 years. If it's a Class B felony, you could stay up to 10 years. And if it's a Class A felony, you could stay for the rest of your life. And so it's important when people are at the hospital is to move through those stages I talked about earlier.
Okay.
And as you move through those stages, hopefully you'll get out before your presumptive maximal. And what we're finding is that attorneys as a group did not know all of the things about the hospital and how the hospital works because they had other cases and they just couldn't focus on their hospital cases. We've changed that.
Oh, good.
And so now we just have a group and all they do is work on these cases. And so now we've been able to help people get out before those statutory maximums. There are also issues with the doctors there. The doctors didn't want to be responsible for saying that this person is ready to move to the next level.
Oh.
So in most of the cases to where we've moved them levels, it's been by agreement of the parties. They just wanted to make sure that there was an attorney there on the defense side that agreed with moving them to the next level. It takes away their liability.
All right. Okay.
So just having someone there has meant that more people are moving up these levels. What that does is that frees up hospital space because that person isn't there anymore. We've had some people there that have been there for 20, 25 years that we've gotten out within the last 2 years. Also within that unit, they had to have a trial about whether someone needed to be at the hospital. And so it was one of the first trials in the state of Washington to decide if someone needed to remain at the hospital or not.
Okay.
And so they kind of had to make up all the rules they went. So that forensic civil commitment program, to me, is pretty extraordinary. The other part of that program involves the Involuntary Treatment Act. And that we have a really small footprint in. But that's the treatment act where if someone is found to be gravely disabled.
Mm.
Or mentally ill, and maybe they're on the street or something. There are certain stages. And so we represent people at the 180-day stage at a couple of hospitals in King County. And we make sure they're represented. And we're sure that that we do what's necessary to determine whether that person gets released or not. It's my hope that we sort of expand that program. That program is one of the limited programs where I could practice. So we have the ability there.
Have y'all worked with homeless clients?
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't say that it's the direct function of this office, but as a public defender, constantly, and that problem has only become greater and greater as our lack of housing. It's the fundamental building block of life. Everyone needs a home. It does come up in our cases. For instance, in our parent representation program, we have some parents that are homeless.
Yeah.
And don't have homes. And so what becomes critical is that housing, because sometimes it's only the fact that they don't have housing, which is interfering with their ability to parent their child. And so no one should lose their child just because they don't have a house.
Right.
I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. It's right. And so we do that work indirectly, but as it comes up on a case-by-case basis, some of the most important work we do for our forensic commitment program is that when people get released or when people are on from McNeil Island, people can be sent to live in the community under conditions. And we want to make sure that when that person is sent out, they're ready to be sent out. We also want to make sure that it's safe for the community.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's just a lot of work that has to be done because that's the exact person that we don't want to be homeless.
Right.
So a lot of it is on that planning for what happens when a person is released.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
So there's a big case. So this office fundamentally supports people having a home. Everyone deserves to have that. I think it's fundamental to being a public defender. You need to have the experience of having a client.
Yeah.
And to have the experience of having someone say, I really need you to help me. I think it's necessary also to have the experience of having a challenging case where you don't like the client and where you find the professionalism to put that aside.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite cases were working with folks who were racist. And then they would have this black attorney who was fighting for them and just to see their minds explode. But also it has an effect on the judge, the prosecutor, and the jury.
That's definitely a powerful learning journey for everyone.
I think that's part of being a public defender.
Yeah.
We're here for everywhere and we leave no one behind.
Yeah.
And so our youth access to counsel program.
Yeah.
And before that program, youth had the right to an attorney just as much as an adult in the Constitution, but they had no one to call. But imagine, I don't know, just being 14, what do 14-year-olds know? And so what they did is they did studies to figure out what do 14-year-olds know about attorneys? It's not a lot. It's a different misconceptions. Also, it's really hard to challenge adults. And so we yeah. had a lot of young people that were confessing to things that they didn't do or talking when they didn't need to. And so what this program allows is it's a phone number that all police have to call if they want to interrogate someone. And so the youth is advised of their rights. Now, we can't tell them what to say or that they can't talk. We just advise them of their rights. Most people, after hearing their rights, exercise them, which is the right to remain silent. And so we've gotten thousands of calls. And the attorneys there are all experienced juvenile attorneys, and they're also trained in crisis intervention, suicide prevention. And so it can be really helpful just to calm a young person down and help them get through a situation. And then in certain situations, we can get people access to counsel faster rather than waiting. If there's a really sensitive investigation that's going on, you can make sure they get access to counsel so we don't have to wait. And so I'm really pleased with that program. There are some critics of that program because youth are exercising their right to remain silent. And sometimes the police were used to the youth just confessing to things. And so that has created some issues, which I think are issues around training. But police officers may have a different point of view. I don't do their job.
Right. You have the recruitment and retention for Rural Public Defense Fellowship.
Yeah, we just activated that program this year.
Yeah.
This was our first year. We had 12 fellows. We got them together in, where did we meet? We met in Ellensburg. They got exposed to experienced attorneys. And then they went out to different locations. So 11 different locations around the state. Two of the locations were tribal. We also work with the Black Public Defenders National Association. So they sent two people. We had folks from Oregon participate in the program. It's a 10-week program. It got rave reviews. A number of them want to continue to practice in those rural communities. I'd say about half of them. I would say that if the state changed some things and decided to give some law school loan forgiveness, we'd probably have 10 new attorneys.
Wow.
12 seems like a low number, but you have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited, and we've already started interviews for next year.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And our recruitment team not only operates in Washington, but I've been in Montana, in Oregon,
oh, wow.
Idaho. And so we are trying to get attorneys from all over the Northwest. And we won't be shy about if we have to go to Florida or whatever to make sure that we get attorneys for the state of Washington. So I'm really proud of that, a program of them being able to set that up this year and have it be so successful.
And the Public Defense Improvement Program.
Yeah, that's in reference to RCW 10101.
Okay.
It received funding, I think, the first time in like 2005. It might have been, I'd say, $6 million at that time. Mm-hmm. In the 20 years from that date, it was never increased. until last year. It doubled.
Hi.
So I really felt listened to by the state legislature. Of course, we need more money for public defense in the state of Washington. But that allows that money to go out around to the different counties. It also is money for certain cities that are able to apply for a certain amount of that. So we work with those cities to get that funding. We have a culture of local control here in the state of Washington, and we don't have a centralized system. And so while I don't get to, comment on that, what I will say is what I want to do with the Office of Public Defense is with each community make the business case that we are their best solution, that we are public defenders, and that when we are called to duty, we will come and fight for folks. And that if we could make that pitch to every community, they can decide whether they want to use our services or not.
Okay. How is the State Office of Public Defense affected by our state's government versus our country's government? So a lot of changes are going on federally.
Our parent representation program is most affected by what's happening federally. We received a fund, we call it 4E. It's actually run by DCYF. And so it's a funding source that goes from the federal government all over the state of Washington. But basically, there's this thing called a penetration rate. But basically, we get reimbursed from the federal government based on how many hours we're working on our parent representation program.
Oh.
And so, luckily, we have continued to receive that funding throughout this last year. If we didn't receive that funding, it would be around maybe $6 to $7 million that we would have lost, which would be a significant, you don't have a source to like replace that. And we'd have to go to our legislature in order to just keep our current level of representation. And so we have continued to receive that money. I don't know when and if it may be cut off.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that it's not. And, yeah, so that's our biggest issue in regards to the federal government. We don't have any other programs with the federal government.
Okay.
At this time, we did have a social worker program that we were doing in a particular county, but that program ended. So that's the issue with the federal government.
I really like how your website is organized, how all of the different documents for filing, the information is clear, and I found that very helpful, how you can just click a link and there's your document right there. You can print it out. But if people have extra questions, how can people reach the office to ask more questions, and how do people obtain forms if online access is not possible for them?
So that's the overall big commitment, is that we work for you. And if you call us, we're going to try to figure out the thing. I personally have a phone hour between 8 and 9 in the morning where I am looking to receive phone calls from folks that are currently incarcerated. It's only 1 hour a day. I usually take 1 or 2 calls a day at that time. But I also set up appointments for folks to discuss their legal issues. Most of the time, I'm going to tell a person, no, we don't do that.
Yeah.
But they still need to talk to a human being. And my job is to either figure out how do I create a new program out of what this person has asked me, or how do I get them to a resource that does provide what they're asking for.
I noticed the resource hub, the Thurston County Resource Hub, is linked on the website.
And I'm very proud of that. I worked at Thurston County before there was that resource hub. As I was leaving and exiting, we were dreaming about what that resource hub could be. And so I've recently been able to go and visit the resource hub. They have some incredible fairs in August. You need to go when they do that again. It's incredible to see a community coming together and providing services for folks. I think that we need to keep that capacity and grow it and extend it. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that we're going to try to be as helpful as possible with getting people access.
And so the resource hub, is that somewhere that you'll send people to go when you're not able to provide anything?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And really what I want to get to the point is that if there's something that happens in a person's life where they think they need public defense, I want them to call us. And then we can start trying to reduce the harm. I don't believe in waiting.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you know, if you're
taking action,
you know, if your drug court's really good, why do I got to wait till I commit a crime to be able to get into it?
For sure. You've got a couple of hotlines listed on your website, voluntary placement agreement and youth access to counsel hotline. We talked about that one already.
The voluntary placement agreement is where there are families that aren't in court yet.
Mm.
But basically they're being told, if you don't make some changes, we may come in and take your child. And so before that hotline, people didn't have anybody to call to discuss whether they should enter into this agreement or not.
That's a scary big decision.
It's huge. So now there's a hotline. There's some things we want to improve from the hotline, meaning that people will call and the attorneys on the hotline will go, well, I want to help you. So we want more funding so that the person can not just make the phone call, but the attorney goes and then
sit. Taking next steps.
And so we, you know, there's some people who volunteer to take those next steps. And so I really appreciate that. That is, I think that hotline is really important.
And so I've seen all the way at the very bottom of the website, there's a link for whistleblowers. What's the whistleblower policy?
To me, when I see that policy, I think that that is in regards to internal issues.
Mm.
So just because I'm the boss doesn't mean that I'm the greatest person in the world. It could be that I make bad decisions. And people need to be able to know about that policy so that we can get audited. So if we have procedures that aren't happening correctly here, everybody's got to be held accountable. And I'm making a bunch of decisions, and I need to be held accountable for those decisions or members of my team. And I think this is very important in regards to public defense. Like I said before, I'm asking for people to object to things that they see are wrong.
And does that extend to attorneys that they have been provided through the Office of Public Defense?
The whistleblower policy, I believe, is more internally based.
Okay.
But I think something that could be improved is customer service in regards to, did I like dealing with my attorney? Do I have a complaint on my attorney?
Okay.
I think that that is critical.
Mm-hmm.
That was critical for me when I worked in the county. Because sometimes you don't get the right perspective just talking to the attorney. Complaints can be very helpful in order to figure out where there are issues and problems. And so I really honored when people call me and say, I didn't like the service that I received.
And how can people get involved? I saw that there were some job opportunities and contracting opportunities listed on your website.
Every once in a while, we get some new programs. And so we're going to be contracting with HCA to help people navigate the substance abuse systems. So there'll be people who are trying to go to treatment, but they might have a warrant or they might have fines. And so we're going to be hiring a couple of paralegals to help those navigators, because the navigators are used to legal processes. You would think that there are people that already exist to help those individuals. And
you're creating a space for that now.
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, and what I'm, you know, I got future plans for that, because again, we have people that are in prison. and sometimes they have awards. And there is no particular entity that is assigned to help those individuals. I think that that's unfair.
Closing those gaps.
And I think we need to close the gap so that when they make the phone call, there's an entity and there's a person that goes, I know the folks in that county. I can get you set up with a hearing so that you can get that addressed. So we're sort of like the oil.
Yeah.
Right?
Greasing the wheels.
No, absolutely. But instead of greasing their wheels for rich people, right, who have money to do those things, they just hire an attorney. We do it for everybody.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's a lot of good work there.
Well, we have a lot of contractors. So we had 80 people here, but 200 or 300 contractors. So there's generally always a little bit of movement. I like the idea that we created there as the application pool so that maybe there's not something open now, but we've already got your application so that when something does come.
Right.
There are some changes around attorney bar licenses and how you get one.
Really?
And so, because there aren't enough attorneys. And so what my hope is that one day this office will be responsible for training folks. In Oregon, you can do a specific program that can train you to be a criminal defense attorney. If you complete law school and then 250 hours, you don't have to pass their bar exam. You just have to have mentored, right? And you can do that work. I have a vision. There's a lot of folks who are in the Department of Corrections right now who would make great paralegals. Well, who are great paralegals, but they would make great ones on the outside. Maybe even while they're in the inside still. But some of them would also be great attorneys. And so I want to open up these opportunities for everyone. You shouldn't have to just go to a law school in order to be an attorney. Law school charges a lot of money. We have the Rule 6 program, which is if you get under the tutelage of an attorney, you can then take the bar exam and become an attorney. And so I'm looking for different ways that we can increase our capacity there as well. So there's, you know, many ways to get here. And so if anybody's listening out there, I'm looking for those pathways. So that if you're interested in being a public defender, I think the maybe one thing that I haven't said is that everybody who works in this office is a public defender. The receptionist is a public defender. They might not have a law degree. Social worker, that's a public defender. The fiscal unit, that's a public defender. Everybody here is a public defender.
The journalist doing this interview is a public defender.
Okay. All right. Yeah, absolutely. So it's about all of this, and it's about all of us doing it together. And there's some things I don't like about our capitalist society, which places value based on a title, but I wish there were some things that were different. But we're all trying to make sure that people get the best representation possible. We all play different roles in making sure that happens. And I just believe that everybody here is a public defender and everybody here is a leader. Because at some point, you're going to have to make a decision. And I want you to make the best decision you can. Doesn't mean that decision won't be wrong. But you're going to make a decision based on the facts you knew at the time. And, you know, not going to get in trouble for that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Is there anything else you would like to share?
I just want to thank you for coming in here and asking me these questions so that more folks can learn about the office different opportunities, or even for folks to listen to this and get upset and say, you know what, I want to make some changes. I really welcome that. And that, you know, making change really fuels why I'm doing this. Because I guess what I like to say is I like winning. And I think people want to win their case. But for me, what's important is winning is the process by which it's done. Because you cannot win every case. Because that's not the decision that is made by a public defender. That might be made by a judge, or it might be made by a jury, or it might be made by the legislature. But what we can control is how we do the job, how we treat people, and how we stand up for others. And that's, you know, what I call winning.
Thank you very much, Larry.
If you would like to learn more or access services, you can visit the State Office of Public Defense online at opd@opd.wa.gov or call the State Public Defenders at 360-586-3164 or toll-free in Washington at 1-800-414-6064. Visit in person at 711 Capitol Way South, Suite 301, Downtown Olympia. To call the Voluntary Placement Agreement Hotline, dial 833-240-9746. If you are a minor in need of legal counsel, please dial the Youth Access to Counsel Hotline at 1-877-578-2333. Larry and his public defenders are waiting to speak with you.
That's it for today's resource report produced by Pathways to Agency. At Pathways to Agency, we are driven by the belief that everyone should have the tools and support to achieve their goals and thrive in their communities. Our mission is to bridge the gaps in understanding, accessibility, and trust by connecting individuals, resources, and sharing information and processes that can lead to personal and community growth. Resource Report offers information about existing and emerging nonprofits and resource organizations. Find out more at pathwaystoagency.org. From there, you can follow the link to our podcast archive and listen to any episode anytime. And check out our YouTube channel. Chaos Radio is not responsible or liable for any views or opinions expressed in the interviews conducted by Resource Report. Till next time, and thanks for listening.